its current state. You're tuned to 90.5 WKAR or WKAR.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. For a number of weeks, I've kept one eye on Clinton County and a proposal there to erect dozens of wind towers. The energy plan comes from a Chicago company, and they've dubbed the project Fowler Farms because of its proximity to the community of Fowler, just west of St. John's. According to reports, the wind energy company, Forest Hill Energy of Chicago, now is suing three townships in the county, alleging that the townships collaborated and conspired to toughen standards for the project and essentially stop it. Apparently, the county adopted one set of wind tower standards. I've been in touch with a few people on the county commission up there. The county adopted one set of standards. These three townships toughened those standards in terms of how much noise they make, how close they can be to subdivisions, homes, what have you. And now the whole thing is headed to circuit court in St. John's. Are you acclimating to wind towers? Are you okay with them? Or are they a blight on the landscape? They are continuing. They continue to become more common in our state. So the question is, to what extent can we coexist? We'll continue to keep an eye on that. Your thoughts always welcome at currentstate@wkar.org. First today, data show Michigan's nearly 700,000 veterans are not connecting with key services that state and federal agencies offer, like employment, health, and education. In fact, recent statistics show that Michigan's veterans rank last in the nation in utilizing federal Veterans Administration benefits. Now, to correct the situation, Governor Rick Snyder announced the creation of a new state agency in his January State of the State address. Last month, the governor approved $3 million to fund the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. Jeff Barnes is a U.S. Army veteran, and he is the agency's first director. We spoke yesterday, and I first asked Director Barnes to rank Michigan on a scale of 1 to 10 in getting important services to veterans.
Well, I got to be honest, we're pretty challenged with being able to do that. The disparate system that a veteran encounters when they come back to the state is one that's pretty disconnected. So when you look, you know, the rankings for the state have gotten a lot of publicity over the past year. We're ranked at the bottom of the barrel, if you will, for services that we provide to veterans. And that's it's not a reflection of just the services that are provided. It's also a reflection of the utilization of the services by the veteran themselves. And so I wouldn't put it in a scale of 1 to 10. What I would say is that what we do as a state is a lot of uncoordinated efforts. We don't plug in very well to the local community. That's an area that's ripe for improvement.
So what are you focusing this effort on exactly?
Well, what we are trying to do with our veterans is make it easier to connect to those benefits that they're eligible for. And the four areas that we're going to focus on with the agency are employment, education, healthcare, and quality of life. Because those are really four areas that if a veteran is connected to, that it will make it easier for them to transition on to the next chapter of their life, wherever they are, regardless if they are just transitioning back from active duty, or if they're a Vietnam veteran that transitioned back several decades ago.
But it sounds like coordination of services really needs an awful lot of attention. Am I right?
Oh, definitely. Within the state government, there are 15 departments and agencies that provide some level of services to veterans. And in the local community, the initial scans that we've done would suggest that there's somewhere around 400 to 450 organizations that might be nonprofit or foundations that provide some service to veterans. And when a vet is coming back and trying to connect to those services, it's a difficult challenge. Sometimes it becomes a disparate system that's difficult to navigate to find those things that you might be eligible for. And, you know, the reason for that's a couple of things. Is the definition for a veteran is not always straightforward. Often what we will try to do is ask whether or not a person has ever served in the armed forces. Because what you'll find is some folks that have served, but maybe not deployed during a combat time, might prematurely exclude themselves from some of the benefits that are eligible for mm-hmm. veterans. And so what we have to do is raise awareness with the veteran and tell them what they're eligible for. and try to connect them to the opportunities that are out there that that they are that are appropriate for their level of service.
So is the bigger challenge not so much that services don't exist, is the bigger challenge just connecting veterans with the service?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
And, Admiral Mike Mullen, the former chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, used to refer to it as a sea of goodwill. And he said, you know, when a soldier is returning to their community, sometimes it's so difficult to be able to figure out where they need to go on that sea of goodwill and how they connect into a pipeline of services that, that help them. And so for, you know, a returning vet that might be coming back from post 9/11, a good start point is trying to get them connected to their education benefits so that they can start that, that pivot point to their next step in their career. And while they're going through that, they're entitled to 5 years of health care that they're eligible for immediately. And so being able to connect them, that gives them an opportunity to get some of those health care services that they might need immediately following service. And then the employment opportunities that are out there that are for veterans, sometimes we lose people. We let them get back into the education system. And then they use the career services at the university, and they forget about the networks that are for veterans to utilize. And so that's we leave some opportunities on the table that would make it easier for our veterans to connect and to move on.
Is it apparent to you at this point how Michigan's situation got so chaotic?
Well, I think it's probably a reflection of a very rapidly changing veterans benefit climate. Since the year 2000, so many things have changed in the veterans arena. Eligibilities for Vietnam veterans have changed over 50 times in that period of time. And so when you look at that, if a veteran hasn't utilized the VA system for a long time, they're not aware of what they're eligible for. The other thing is that they just don't know the quality of service that it currently exists. This is certainly a different VA than what it was 15 years ago.
How do veterans' needs vary by age and by sex, for that matter? We've got women veterans, we've got male veterans. How do those vary?
Sure. That's a great question. When you look at how we deliver the structure of services, at different points in your life, you need different things. It's really not different than any a civilian would go through. Sometimes the need for health care is more escalated than maybe the need for education services. And so there are a lot of different programs out there. What's most important for us in the customer service aspect is to connect with the veteran, figure out where they are in their life situation, and then find out the program that are applicable for them.
You mentioned four areas that you're going to focus on: employment, education, health care, and quality of life. Which of those four do you think is going to take up most of your time?
Well, that's another good question. That's one that I think you're going to spend quite a bit of time in each one of those. You know, one of the things that that I think we will find just the initial look at this problem, employment is a huge piece, and you'll find that a lot of times our veterans who have returned back might be, there's a phenomenon that they refer to as couch surfing. They have difficulty, they live with a family member and they want to move on to another family member or friend while they're looking for employment. They might be having difficulty settling back in the civilian community. And so employment is a huge component of this, being able to be able to help that veteran transition into a quality of life is extremely important. Our veterans are very mission focused, and that's the way that that we've been through our service, through combat. And so to come back and not really have that mission and not have that stability in life is very unsettling. And then you compound that with a lack of ability to get connected to healthcare, or maybe you are at a position where you can't get employed because you feel that you don't have the education credentials to go to a position that you might have held in the military, results in a lot of our veterans being underemployed. And I think that contributes to an overall level of frustration and unhappiness in that transition back into the civilian community.
You served in the U.S. Army. You tell a memorable story about being in a job interview after your Iraq tour. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, sure. I had just come to the state of Michigan and was interested in integrating back, and it really speaks to the thing that I just spoke about with underutilization. You come back and you have been able to do great things in the military, have charged with a lot of responsibility. In my case, I had, between two tours of combat, had led nearly 700 soldiers into combat and brought everyone home alive. Yet I sat in a civilian job interview and was actually asked by the interviewer, said, "You have a very impressive resume, but have you had any leadership experience?" And to me, that was very humbling and very frustrating at the same time. I knew what I had accomplished on the battlefield, and I was very confident with the tasks and the leadership opportunities that I had in the military. But to come back and to be told if I wanted to go into management, I should look into night security positions or look into things that I felt that I was overqualified for, really frustrated me, because I didn't feel like maybe I was articulating my skill set very clearly, or that people really understood what I was trying to bring to the workplace and to their company. And so that is really a situation that is not all that uncommon when you talk to veterans. It is a difficulty of communicating the opportunities that you've had in the military, the responsibilities that you've had, and how those skill sets can translate into that civilian workplace.
Jeff, what can the average Michigan citizen do to help the lot of the veterans living in the state?
You know, the first thing is encourage the veteran to connect with a veteran service officer or a county veterans counselor. That is a great interim step to do that initial triage point of seeing if the veteran is eligible for benefits, if they need help with employment, and being able to connect into that network of services. The other thing I would encourage the veteran to do is to continue to look at the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency website at michigan.gov. And over the coming weeks and months, we're going to change that website into more of a customer service experience where you'll be able to connect with some of those opportunities. And we'll have customer service reps as we build out the organization that will actually be able to help you troubleshoot some of your questions, whether it's for you as an individual veteran or for you as a family member of a veteran, to help make that connection.
Jeff Barnes is a U.S. Army veteran, and he is Michigan's first director of the Veterans Affairs Agency. Jeff Barnes, best of luck. Thanks for joining us on Current State.
Thank you so much.
Current State on WKAR. By the way, if you need to know more about the music that you hear on our show, an awful lot of time and energy goes into that too, by the way, you can find out on our Twitter feed. Follow us at KAR, Current State. One other note today, MSU graduates get some pretty high-profile commencement speakers here come May. Novelist Richard Ford, an MSU alumnus and author of Independence Day, which won a Pulitzer Prize, is one of them, and actor Tim Busfield will address undergrads on May 3rd. So that should be pretty special commencement here. Next to the Capitol in the basement of Central United Methodist Church in downtown Lansing is a day drop-in center where homeless individuals can rest, eat, and do laundry. It's called Open Door Ministry. We feature it in today's Neighbors in Action segment. And here to tell us more about the work of Open Door Ministry is Dennis Ranville, the center's co-director, along with Ira Savage, a formerly homeless client at Open Door who is currently a volunteer there. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Mark.
Nice to be here.
Thanks for coming in. Tell us a little bit more about Open Door Ministry and the work you do, Dennis.
Well, I'll give you a quick history of it. The history at Central United Methodist goes back about 30 years to a soup kitchen that they founded at that time. And Open Door has grown out of that. Approximately 10 years ago, we were incorporated as a 501c3 organization, and we moved to the entire lower level of the church. We are, as you say, a drop-in center or a day shelter, sometimes we call it. We try to create a safe place environment, and by that we mean physically, emotionally safe, so that people can be comfortable when they come in there. You know, a lot of the people that stay in the overnight shelters have to leave in the morning and can't go back in until the evening.
Mm-hmm.
So they have nowhere to go during the day. And we offer a place to to be. There's always something to eat. We serve a couple of hot meals a few days a week. There's always something to eat. It's fellowship. We offer a variety of services. We have a phone available for people to use. People, as you say, can do laundry. We have shower facilities. We offer storage space so you don't have to carry a big black plastic bag around town.
So a number of really key core services.
Key personal needs.
Ira, I understand you first arrived at Open Door 3 years ago?
Yeah, about 3 years ago.
What was your situation like at the time?
Well, I was homeless. I was in prison, ran into a fire with the law some time ago. It's in prison. And I grew up downstate, so I basically came up here to get out of that environment and found myself homeless. So I came to Open Door, and ex-director there was Chris Bobier, you know, and they took me in, you know, they gave me, you know, services, bus fare, you know, place to go to help me get jobs and stuff like that. And I started volunteering, and Chris and Dennis came to me and asked me, you know, do I want to, you know, just volunteer down there. So I started volunteering, got more and more responsibility now. I volunteer down there like 5 days a week.
That happens a lot, doesn't it?
Oh, it does.
I mean, somebody in need of a service becomes affiliated with an agency, and they become one of the strongest disciples of the service.
Well, and actually, we call those our community volunteers.
Okay.
And I do want to credit Ira. Ira is there 5 days a week, almost all day long, every day. He's really done a great job at coming forward and being there and helping out.
And it offered you some stability, Ira, when you needed it. Where are you now, then, exactly, in your life?
Well, in my life, I'm not where I want to be, but I'm actually ahead where I want to be. You know, I have a place to stay now. Well, I stay with somebody. But my life is more stable, and, you know, and Open Door has helped me tremendously, and I see them helping a lot of other, you know, homeless people, or if not homeless, people that's not well off to do on their own.
So. Right. How many people do you serve, Dennis?
We have a long tradition of a Thursday fellowship lunch. We get approximately 120 to 150 people there for lunch every Thursday. On any given day during the week, we probably have from 40 to 70 people at a time that will come in, just sit, just be there for one reason or another.
And what's one of the more memorable encounters you've had, Dennis, since you've been doing this? Something that stands out in your memory? How long have you been at this again?
I have been there about 4 years. I started as a volunteer. I had a chance to take an early retirement and looked for a place to do some volunteer work. And after a while, they asked me to join the staff, and I've had a couple positions since. One of the stories that I always remember has touched me. There's a gentleman who came in about a year and a half ago, 60-some years old, had been a contractor in the area, very successful business. He tells me that he said, I had a $250,000 home, I had two brand new pickup trucks, I had a couple crews of people that worked with me. And he said, I got sick, developed some health issues. The general work slowdown affected him. He lost his home. His marriage fell apart. And he said, Dennis, he said, I owe Sparrow Hospital $350,000, and I'm staying at the rescue mission. I had no idea my life would end up like this.
Wow.
And this is, you know, a guy who just a few years ago was probably riding on top of the world with his work, his business, and so on. So.
Yeah.
Just the other side of that real quickly is we spent some time with a guy who came to us out of prison about a year and a half ago, had been in prison 24 years, and was just anxious to kind of reestablish himself in the world. So we helped him get his birth certificate, ID, assisted him and referred him to where he could apply for Social Security disability, which he was qualified for, helped him get a bank account. And I helped him move. I put some of the stuff in my car and helped him move into an apartment, which is really nothing fancy, just a room. And when we were moving in, he was quiet for a moment. I looked at him, and he had tears in his eyes, and he said, "Dennis, I got my own key." He said, "It's the first time in my life I've had my own key to my own place."
Wow.
So, you know, these are the kinds of stories that we have. There is something very touching that happens almost every day there, and it's a real reward to be around there.
Ira Savage, as a formerly homeless person yourself, you obviously have an awful lot of empathy for the people that you're helping.
Oh, yes. They come through every day. You see them come through every day like that, needing help. And it's kind of gratifying when you see you can help people and get back on their feet, like, you know, provide them transportation to get to job interviews and, you know, just give them something to eat. And I'd like to thank right now that one of the co-directors there, Bobby Morrison, she does a wonderful job there, you know, in helping people. And, you know, and I notice a lot of people, you know, they come to me and tell me what a wonderful job Bobby did or Dennis did, and, mm-hmm. you know.
Real gratifying.
Yes.
Go ahead, Dennis.
I wanted to, again, just reiterate what Ira said. Bobby Morris is our executive director and is kind of in charge of the overall operational aspect of Open Door. My role has shifted more to communications and outreach because we see a need to make ourselves more known, more present in the community, and to encourage donations, funding, look for volunteers, a variety of help that we can use. I find that if you ask people, they will come forward. So my job is more about asking for help right now.
Are these people who have been, are the people you serve then, typically, are they longtime mid-Michigan people? Are there people coming in from other areas?
Well, they come from a variety of areas. You know, Mark, people still get on a bus in one town because they want to go someplace else, and they get off the bus in a new city and say, "Where can I go? What, you know, what's around?" You know, the Lansing bus station is the downtown bus station is a real hub of information, especially for the homeless and the underserved communities. And we find that people there refer people who come to town to us. So we can get to know them a little bit, understand their needs, and refer them or deal with them ourselves with some of the things that we help with.
And tell our listeners how they can get involved in the work that you do.
We have a need for, always have a need for financial donations. We need volunteers to come in and take a half-day shift. We're open 8:30 to 4, 5 days a week. We need donations of clothes, personal items. People say, "What can I do?" We try to keep a supply of bus tokens around or bus passes. Any of the things, and as far as donations, I tell people, think of a home medicine cabinet. Aspirin, Band-Aids, shoelaces, cold medicines. Any of those things are things that people come to us and ask for, so we try to stay up on that.
Okay. Dennis Ranville, yeah, continue, please.
I just want to make one plug. On May 10th, Friday, May 10th, we're having one of the first real fundraisers that we've had. It's a dinner and dance. We one of our chef is a guy who has come through the system and came to Open Door as a guest himself, is now our chef, is going to be cooking the dinner. So we have a dinner, we have a dance, we have a DJ lined up, and several of the groups that dance at Central United Methodist, there's a contra dance group and several others, have offered to come in and be part of the entertainment for the evening. So it's going to be a real fun evening. If anybody's interested, they can call Central at 485-9477, ask for either Bobby Morris or me, and we'll be happy to arrange tickets and give you any more information you need.
Sounds great. Dennis Ranville is the co-director of the Open Door Ministry in Lansing. Ira Savage is a former consumer of Open Door services and currently a volunteer there. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mark.
We know there are great people and organizations out there that are doing great work in mid-Michigan, and we don't know about them. We want to change that. You know about them, and we need your help. If you know of a person or organization that's doing great work in the community, let us know. Send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. You can even nominate yourself if you like. In fact, today's segment about Open Door Ministry, nominated by Dennis Ranville. MSU's College of Communication, Arts, and Sciences is hosting its inaugural Spartan Sports Journalism Classic. Tomorrow, the event will feature panel discussions with top sports journalists working in print, television, radio, and, of course, online. MSU basketball great Steve Smith is the host and moderator here in East Lansing, and here to tell us more about the event is the Dean of the College of Communication, Arts, and Sciences, Pamela Witten. Good morning, Pam.
Good morning, Mark.
And our regular contributor to Current State and panelist as well at this event, the Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexroad. Hi, Joe.
Hi there. How you doing?
We're doing great. You've caught up on your sleep, I trust.
getting there.
Our listeners are hearing about the Spartan Sports Journalism Classic for the first time. Pamela Witten, in your own words, what is it?
You know what? It's actually the first time that we're celebrating all that the College of Communication, Arts, and Sciences does in the field of sports journalism. So we do an amazing job educating students, and we have a cadre of alum in just doing amazing work in the field. And we realized, wow, now that we work with WKAR in the college and are moving more aggressively toward including sports as part of the full cultural package of WKAR and doing some aggressive things, we decided let's have a day. And we swung really big. And based on what's happening tomorrow, I think we really have hit something out of the park.
Okay. Joe Rexroad, you've arrived in sports journalism with the Free Press. What was it like for you when you first started in the business, and did you have mentors in this career trajectory of yours?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'll go back to, you know, Journalism 200 and Michael Drager, who is not around anymore, but he was a fantastic professor, and that, you know, that class is still like the basis for everything I do, you know. And Eric Friedman, which was a magazine writing class, and there's more. I think there's more emphasis now on the sports writing. I talk to Sue Carter's class often. She has a specific sports writing class, which I think are great because there are differences, in sports journalism versus other forms, even, you know, in print journalism. So, and then, of course, the state news was a lot of mentors there, and then as I went on in the business. So I'm excited about tomorrow, and actually a lot of my classmates are going to be a part of it too. So there may be some inside jokes, but we'll try to keep those to a minimum.
Are there, Pam Witten, are there relatively a lot more MSU journalism school graduates working in sports than at a lot of other schools?
Yeah. This is actually something we're very good at. First of all, we have a great school of journalism, and so kudos to Joe for all he does. But he's also a very well educated journalist, frankly, as well. And if you go look around the United States at people that work in the field of sports broadcasting as journalists or analysts, so many of them come from Michigan State, and that's why something that started out as a kind of a call out, we're going to do something big, has resulted in a cadre of MSU alum from USA Today, Milwaukee Brewers, Michigan Hockey Magazine, Sport Magazine, Fox Sports Detroit, Fox Sports South, Big Ten, NBA Channel, Golf Channel, you name it, Detroit Free Press, et cetera, folks are coming in. And I want to stress, these alum are all coming in on their own dime to do this work with students and with the community as well. And, if I can just tell you this day, it starts tomorrow in the morning, and we've got over 20 MSU alum coming back in. First thing they do in the morning is their SWAT team across journalism classes. So they're going to go in teams, and they're going to tell their stories. And, Joe, hopefully you guys are going to keep them pretty clean for us at this point. So they're going to tell their stories to students. Then we've got a lunch, and then we have this thing called speed coaching, and the J school students had to apply and try out to get a spot. 40 of them get to do it. And what they do is, it's like speed dating. They get 5 minutes with one of these professional alums. They get to make their pitch, if you will, and then we've got faculty that are going to be literally wearing referee jerseys and whistles. They blow the whistle and they move on to the next professional. And so they're going to get to do a dozen of these mentoring coaching opportunities. Then we move into the actual panel discussion being recorded and streamed live that Steve Smith is graciously hosting for us. We've got two panels, one addressing day-to-day tricks to being a successful sports journalist, and we've got Mateen Cleaves from CBS, Rick Gosselin from Dallas Morning News, Joe, you're on that panel, Al Toby from Yahoo, an amazing group. And then the second panel is on the future of sports journalism with Jarrett Bell from USA Today, Jeff Gethner, who runs Fox Sports South, Lynn Henning from Detroit News, Greg Kelser, Special K, so amazing. And then we're closing out the day with an invitation dinner to really pay tribute to Earl Robinson, who is retiring after 39 years at WKAR. Did a lovely job. We decided to have a little fun with it. So rather than the traditional long, boring speeches, we're having the dinner on the Quizbuster set, and we're going to have basically a sports trivia game show as a tribute to Earl instead. And then as a final culmination, we have sealed the deal today with Earl's replacement, which we will be announcing tomorrow.
All right. So we've got a sports talk replacement here coming to WKAR. We'll be getting to know soon. Joe Rexroad, I'm curious, on a day-to-day basis, what do you do that you are most interested in sharing with a young, budding sports journalist?
Yeah, well, I should figure this out before tomorrow, shouldn't I?
There's probably a few things, I realize. What is it on a day-to-day basis that you struggle with, perhaps, that you're most eager to impart to a young sports journalist?
Well, it's funny because the job has actually changed so much just in the last few years.
Yes.
It really used to be sort of each day is its own cycle, and you're thinking about the next day's paper and what's going to be in it, and you have time to develop some things and you think in terms of the next day. Now it's minute by minute, and it's you have to be plugged in at all times, and you have to be ready to right now I'm waiting to hear, is Adrian Payne going to do something with the draft? It's instant, so you have to be very flexible, and you really have to be willing to work all the time. And then you have to, I talk to classes quite a bit, and I say, you need to be calling people, even if there isn't something going on. You need to be keeping in touch with your sources at all times. I think that's a big thing. Building relationships, staying informed. Again, even if it's not for a specific story, you have to be, thinking about that at all times and keeping communication up at all times. I think those, that's, and again, it's just a little different now with Twitter and with so many different sources of information. I mean, there are people now who will come with stories that I had not heard of before, you know, something's tweeted out. You know, it may be someone who's tied to an agent. That happened last week with some Michigan basketball players. And now you have to react to it. Mm-hmm. You have to write it, and you have to cite the report. And so it's a different world. But you know, I think people, young people now are going to be more equipped for that because that's kind of what they're used to.
Right. You've had to make a transition. I've had to make a transition that has been more challenging for us than young people who are really immersed in this thing. Young people who have never seen a phone hanging on a wall have a whole lot easier time than you and I have. But it's going to continue to evolve, I'm sure. Pam, you're not only the dean of the School of Communication Arts and Sciences, you have a reputation in this building for being an intense sports fan. What's the magic of sports for you?
It's, gosh, where do you start? Oh, my gosh.
Is it the competition?
It's the joy of the competition, but it's also just the fun of, you know, people pushing themselves, you know, to limits that they don't know that they can necessarily do. And for those of us that don't necessarily have the physical ability to match those skills, to live vicariously through the fun of all the sports and, you know, to get to second guess. I mean, you know, Joe, I got to be honest. It's fun to talk to you in person, but I read your column and I'm talking to you and I'm yelling at you and disagreeing with you sometimes, you know, because it's the joy of the judgment in sports as well. That's so much fun.
Joe, what makes good sports journalism? What's at the heart of good sports journalism, as far as you're concerned?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it's the exact same thing that's at the heart of good journalism. And I think that's why it's so important that the people who are doing these jobs are people who are educated. And that's what I tell students, too. You know, we need you out here. You know, we need people who have actually developed these skills and have gone and covered a school board meeting or covered city government, covered cops and courts. That to me is what has to be at the heart of it. And unfortunately, we have too many people who are in sports journalism who don't have that background, who don't have those basic skills.
Right.
So, I mean, I think it starts there, and then from there, of course, it's different. It's, there's just nothing else like it in journalism in terms of covering games. I mean, you're writing a lot of, the personality profiles. I do think human interest, that's just a big thing for me. That's what I like to get into.
Right.
And I think people enjoy reading it. But I think you also have to be able to deal with, the economics of sport. You certainly are going to have to do police stories covering a sports beat. So I mean, I think you have to be diverse.
Lots more scandal in sports than there used to be, mm-hmm. too. That's the reality of the situation. A day full of events and activities tomorrow, part of the Spartan Sports Journalism Classic, the inaugural event. Pamela Witten is the dean of MSU's College of Communication Arts and Sciences. Joe Rex Rhodes, a sports reporter for the Detroit Free Press, and will be a panelist at tomorrow's event. Thanks for to both of you for joining us.
Thank you. And Joe, we'll see you tomorrow.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot.
Tomorrow on Current State, Terry Stanton of the Department of Treasury in the state of Michigan responds to criticism regarding billions of dollars in uncollected state tax revenue. Also, we preview the cultural event, Latin is America. That and more Thursday here on Current State. The executive producer of our show is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Andy Curtis and Yensia Wong for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu And by Astera Credit Union, a proud supporter of Current State's Neighbors in Action segment. Newest location is now open on West Saginaw Highway on Lansing's west side. Information at AsteraCU.com.